Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historic Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased to have with us Professor Roger Morehouse. Professor Morehouse is a visiting professor at the College of Europe in Warsaw. He is the author of a good number of well-received books. And today we are speaking about his latest book, Poland 1939. The Outbreak of World War II, published by Basic Books. Welcome, Professor Morehouse.
Hello, good afternoon.
Professor, why did you write this book?
It was a rather obvious sort of follow-on from my previous book, which was published in 2014, which was called The Devil's Alliance, about the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which, of course, you know, predates the invasion of Poland by about a week. So this was a natural follow-on from that book. It sort of deals broadly with the same sort of time frame in the same area of the world. And more broadly than that, it's a subject that is a sort of huge gap, really, in our collective understanding of World War II. I don't have too much interest in sort of retreading the areas of history that are already well trodden. So I'd much rather do subjects that are less well known, where I can actually feel like I'm making some sort of contribution. So I think this certainly fell into that category. It's a very interesting subject that traditionally gets overlooked. I would suggest the Polish campaign in many ways sort of sets the standard. A rather horrible standard, but it sets a standard for the ongoing conflict of World War II. It has all the traits of the way the war was conducted going forward, the targeting of civilians, ideologically driven warfare, indiscriminate aerial bombing, all of those sort of traits are there in the September campaign. So it has a lot really to discuss and a lot to get our teeth into collectively. So that's the main reason why I wanted to do it, because usually it gets passed over in a couple of paragraphs or a couple of pages. And there's a lot more there to discuss than we traditionally take for granted.
So there has not been a monograph written, or if so, it's rather obscure and few in number, in English language on this campaign.
Yes, that's true. There have been a couple of monographs on it, but they tend to fall very sort of squarely into the category of military history, and military history tends to be sometimes of questionable sort of lyrical quality, shall we say. So it's not something that you would necessarily, that the ordinary reader of history would necessarily sort of curl up in bed with. And I wanted to, in a sense, sort of bring this story out of its a little bit of a military history ghetto, perhaps, and bring it out of that and make it more accessible. So, I mean, I'm not a military historian. I'm really a political historian. But I wanted to cover this story because it hadn't been done. And I think it's relevant and there's something there to be said. I wanted to write a sort of non-military history, if that makes sense. So it's a sort of human history of military events, if that makes sense. That's how I sort of justified it to myself. So I wanted lots of first-hand accounts and to actually, you know, enable the reader to understand what was going on and understand, you know, the Polish perspective on these things. I think that was quite a crucial aim to set out with.
If your book could be said to have a thesis, what would it be?
There's a couple of points to make. The first one is the one I made just a little bit earlier, that there's, you know, all the traits that this campaign has, I think, been forgotten by history generally or overlooked. All of the main traits of World War II warfare are there. So it sort of contradicts the idea that this was in some way irrelevant, which I think might be the assumption. So that would be point one. The second one is that in the absence of sort of knowledge and study of this period, we're left effectively with the wartime propaganda on both sides. On the German side, that this was, you know, a walkover, that it was a very vastly superior to, you know, technologically adept force destroying a much more primitive force, and all this sort of stories that ran along with that. You know, for example, the long-standing myth of cavalry against tanks and so on. That's one that I wanted to try and demolish and get to the bottom of. So we're left effectively with wartime mythology on both sides, the German side, as I've just described, and then the Soviet side, which effectively denied that they were there at all. There was, of course, a Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939, which even Mr. Putin still tries to deny on occasion. So that's an important point to make, that we are left with Soviet wartime mythology, which needs to be challenged. And the last point, I think, is to suggest that there's a Polish voice here that has been ignored. Where this is talked about at all, it's talked about through almost exclusively through German sources and through a German prism. And to do the story justice, I wanted to bring as many Polish voices into the forum, into the discussion as possible. So that meant a trawl through the archives. So there's a number of threads there that I wanted to bring out very strongly in writing the book.
What were the expectations of the Polish High Command about how the Germans would fight the campaign?
I think this again is one of those areas where I think we are languishing a little bit in the world of wartime mythology. The Poles were really under no illusions that they would be up against a very stern test in 1939. They knew the Germans were much better equipped than they were, had much more, much better equipment, much better technology, even a better military doctrine. But they were always minded to fight. Incidentally, the Poles were always minded to fight. They weren't going to surrender their sort of hard-won independence of 1918. They weren't going to surrender that easily or lightly. So they initially went on a search, of course, for foreign allies, which they did. They secured the alliance of the British and the French shortly before the outbreak of war. And in that way, they expected to be able to at least hold out long enough so that the British and the French could assist them in the West and could relieve the pressure on themselves. And they wanted to make sure that, you know, Germany was aware that if it attacked Poland, it would be incurring the wrath of London and Paris as well. So their response to this, you know, they're quite aware that the Germans are numerically and technologically superior to them. But their response is both a military and a sort of strategic one, to try and make sure that any attack on them would not be without consequence. And that they did try to do. They did fulfill all of those criteria. Unfortunately, their Western allies rather let them down, which is, again, a major theme of the book.
Why did the Polish plan of campaign consist mostly of fighting the Germans at the frontier rather than in the interior?
That's a very good question. The Polish state, as it was reconstituted in 1918, took a lot of territory from the collapsed empires around it. So this was obviously, there are very few defined boundaries in this area of Central and Eastern Europe, unfortunately, for all concerned. So Poland had been, which was, you know, going back to the 17th century, was the largest state in Europe, for example, and stretched from the Baltic almost to the Black Sea. By the time of, the 19th century, Poland had ceased to exist. It had been gobbled up by its neighbours, culminating in 1795 with the last of the partitions. So Poland is wiped from the map at that point. So it doesn't exist effectively in the 19th century. So by the time those three empires that had partitioned her collapsed themselves, as they did at the end of the First World War, so Russia, Germany, and Austria-Hungary, all three collapsed at the end of the First World War, then Poland is again free to emerge from the ruins. And it does so by taking territory which has been claimed by one side or the other at some point. So there are various competing territorial claims going on. And in the German case, this is particularly important because of the competing claims to the Polish corridor and to Danzig, for example, both of which are sort of heavily populated by Germans. So by the time you jump forward to 1939, the Poles are really not keen to sort of cede territory to the Germans, because this was territory that the Germans obviously claimed. But the Poles were very keen not to fall into the same trap, if you like, of allowing Hitler a free run. They wanted any sort of territorial transgression to have an effect and trigger some sort of diplomatic reaction. So that meant effectively, if you look at the map, if you look at a wartime map or pre-war map between Germany and Poland, you'll see it's a very different shape from how it is today. Poland strategically is in a very difficult situation. It's surrounded on three sides by German territory. So it's in a very difficult situation. And logic would probably dictate, objectively speaking, that Poland should have ceded territory, at least allowed its forces to retreat to some sort of at least semi-defensible lines. But the political imperative was not to give anything away, because you didn't want the British and the French to have any excuse by which they could say, well, if you're not going to defend yourselves, then we're not going to defend you either. You know, so it was a strategic decision made, political decision was made, that they would defend the frontier. So I have this sort of almost like a tripwire effect, so that if any German incursion would meet Polish forces, and that would trigger, hopefully, a political reaction, and the Western allies would come to their rescue. So it was an important calculation. It's quite clear that this was militarily rather nonsensical, or at least ill-advised, but it was a political calculation that they would actually defend the frontiers.
And in fact, weren't there demonstrations in Poland in the summer, late spring, summer of 1939, spontaneous, apparently not orchestrated by the Sanjaka regime, about not giving in to German demands?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Poland is, as I said, it has this sort of rich history going back into the Middle Ages and beyond. And then it ceased to exist in 1795, and it's reconstituted after 123 years after the collapse of its partitioning powers. So there's a sort of a nationalistic hangover, we might say. Poland is one of those countries that is dying to sort of reconstitute itself, which it does after the First World War. And consequently, you know, for good or ill, the Poland that emerges is quite nationalistic in tone. It wants to secure its own place on the world map and its place in history, and it's not minded to give anything away to anyone. So again, there are these sort of demonstrations of opposition to any idea of concessions to Germany, because it was perhaps a possibility that, you know, German saber rattling over Danzig or over the Polish corridor could feasibly have been have resulted or been quietened, rather, by some sort of territorial concession. That's an open question as to whether that would actually have met Hitler's demands and meant that he would back down. Personally, I doubt it. There's a much deeper and much more sinister agenda going on in Berlin. But the initial demands were for territorial access across the Polish corridor and for the cession of Danzig from the League of Nations. So, yes, there were initially the suggestion was that territorial concessions, you know, if they were made, would satiate Berlin.
How influenced?
A good proportion of Polish opinion was against those ideas.
Yes. That is the case, and that it comes out very clearly in the German diplomatic dispatches from Warsaw to Berlin, where they were actually rather taken aback by the degree of popular opposition. So, in fact, Josef Beck, the Polish foreign minister, had very few very little, I should say, leeway to work out a settlement.
And again, I would doubt whether even had those territorial demands of Germany's been met by the Poles, I would doubt whether that would necessarily stave off any sort of further German demands or German attack. I mean, Germany is accelerating in its sort of headlong rush to expand territorially, and actually in a headlong rush to war at this point. So, and it's becoming ever bolder. Certainly Hitler himself is becoming ever bolder at this time. So even, as I said, even had those territorial demands been met by the Poles, personally, I doubt whether it actually would have prevented conflict in the longer term.
How influenced was the Polish military mind in terms of the 1939 campaign, by the Russo-Polish War of 1920, and in particular the miracle on the Vistula in August 1920?
That's a good question. A lot of those sort of senior commanders in the Polish military in 1939 were veterans of the Polish-Bolshevik War and of the Battle on the Vistula, Battle of Warsaw in 1920. So it did sort of loom large, and this was again it was described in sort of in the popular Polish mind as described as the miracle on the Vistula. So it's seen as a sort of miraculous victory against a superior opponent. So there's a lot of the thinking in 1939 is broadly along the lines of, well, yes, we might be up against it, against the Germans, but we've done this before. We have defeated a superior opponent before. We've grasped victory from the jaws of defeat as we did in 1920. So we can do that again. So this is sort of part of the folk memory to some extent. And it has other effects as well, because this sort of the memory of the 1920 war, 1919-1920 war, is one that sort of coloured Polish military thinking all through the 1930s, and actually delayed the development of any sort of armoured and motorised arm in the military. So this was an important consequence. It's often said that, you know, any army is essentially refighting the last war that it fought at any one time. And for the Germans, for the British, for the French, that is, you know, the last engagements of the First World War, which were very sort of tank heavy. This is the beginnings of armoured warfare. So a lot of them are, you know, people like Guderian in Germany, people like Fuller in Britain, and someone like de Gaulle in France. They're all thinking about, armoured warfare as the future. And they're pushing to have that adopted as the strategy for the military going forward. But for the Poles, the last war they fought effectively was 1920 against the Soviets, which was not a war of tanks and armor. It was a war predominantly of cavalry. So they're rather stuck. I mean, this is aside from any sort of economic concerns. Poland fundamentally couldn't afford to build up a large armored force in the interwar years. It simply didn't have the money, but it also didn't really have the ethos. It didn't have the idea, because that was not the previous conflict that it had fought. So this is, to some extent, explains why cavalry was still so predominant in Polish forces in 1939, because it's the long hangover from 1920.
Would it be correct to say that the first few days of the campaign, particularly the first two or three, were effectively a stalemate?
To some degree. Where it's interesting that, you know, the German narrative of all of this is that Poland effectively crumbled and Polish forces were ineffectual, and they collapsed pretty much from day one. And to some extent, you can see that played out on the ground. So it's, you know, for example, German spearheads reach Warsaw, which is quite a good distance from the German frontier. But they reach Warsaw already on the 8th of September, so after a little over a week. They do then rather stall, and elements are withdrawn to sort of deal with Polish forces elsewhere. So that it's not, the capital is not yet encircled on the 8th, but they certainly reach the suburbs on the 8th. So it doesn't look good if you look at, you know, the dates like that. You know, they reach the capital already after day 8. But actually, if you look in more granular detail at some of the engagements on the first few days of the war, you can see that actually the Poles, particularly where they had static defences to defend, they actually could fight the Germans to a standstill. And there are a number of very good examples of that. You know, places like Węgierska Górka in the south, or like the Mława defences up in the north to the north of Warsaw. In those instances where they had static defences, where they had prepared lines, they could actually hold the Germans up very, very effectively. And there's another set piece battle down at Mokra, down in the southwest towards the Silesian frontier, where again Polish cavalry, this was, fought a very effective fighting retreat against the German 4th Panzer Army, and this was, you know, very much the spearhead that was heading for Warsaw, but they were halted effectively for a good 24 hours at Mokra. So the Poles could actually hold up German forces very effectively, particularly where they had static defences. But the problem was that in all too many instances, there were no static defences and no natural obstacles that could be exploited to that effect. So in too many areas, they were being effectively routed at the frontier, and then having nowhere, they couldn't retreat fast enough. They were being outrun even in their retreat. So that was the primary problem that they had.
And wasn't the additional problem is that of reserves? When the Germans broke through, there was no sufficient amount of reserves to throw in to cover the gap.
The Poles did have reserve armies. You know, their dispositions were sort of quite well thought out. As I said, they were defending the frontier line broadly, but they did have reserves in place. That one of the problems I think that you're alluding to really is that of the sort of rather halting mobilization that they'd put into place. And they'd wanted to mobilize already at the end of August so that they had their forces in place. But they had been advised against by the British and the French, who wanted effectively that there should be no possible sort of provocation, inverted commas, any sort of provocation of Berlin, any act that might be perceived as provocation by Hitler. So they'd prevailed upon the Poles to delay their mobilization. And that meant that in many instances, by the time they're actually attacked on the morning of the 1st of September, some of their forces are only up to about sort of 60% strength, because the men are not in place, the materials are not in place, the tanks are not in place, the horses are not there, whatever it is. So that was a fundamental problem. That's across the board. That's frontline units as well as reserves. So although on paper the dispositions look quite good and the reserves are in place, the reality was somewhat different, that many of those units were vastly under strength. But it's primarily because of that delayed mobilization.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Why did not the British and the French actively assist the Poles by attacking the German fortification, the so-called Siegfried Line in the west of Germany?
That's one of the sort of great, I suppose, what ifs of the book. The British and the French obviously committed to action in Poland's defence. The French actually made concrete commitments. I think the French betrayal of the Poles is actually arguably the greater of the two. The French made concrete commitments to the Poles that they would attack in the West on after day 15 of mobilisation. They attempted to do so. There is this sort of very minor assault called the Saar Offensive, which begins on the 8th of September and effectively advances about 5 kilometres for about 4 or 5 days and then withdraws again. Really redefines half-hearted. It's very half-hearted indeed. And the open question is, you know, what would have happened had the French, I mean, bear in mind that, you know, this is only a week into the war, so British forces are not yet present on the continent. So that to some extent excuses them of sort of complicity in that failure. So the Saar Offensive is a French show. But the question, open question is, well, what might have been achieved had they attacked with any sort of vigour at all? And actually, I think, you know, even from the German side, the German commander in the West was astonished that the French were so half-hearted, because he expected to actually have a fight on his hands. And he knew that his own forces had been stripped to the bone. So he barely had any up-to-date armor. He barely had air cover because everything had been sent to the East to try and dispatch Poland as quickly as possible. So had they actually attacked with any sort of vigor against this rather denuded Western German army, then they could have scored some notable successes. But unfortunately, in the French case, as in the British, there was no political will to actually proactively take the fight to Germany in 1939. So they had enough political will to declare war, as they did on the 3rd of September, but they didn't actually have enough political will to actually take the war to Germany. So that you're left with this effectively a sort of a, if you don't attack us, we won't attack you mentality, which prevails until May 1940, when, of course, the Germans attack.
What, if any, were the Polish military plans to deal with the possible two-front war, Germany on one side in the West, the Soviet Union in the East?
The answer to that is very little. I mean, if you look at the map, Poland is very exposed to the Germans alone in the West. As I said, you have this almost, in the jaws of a German pincer in the Western area with East Prussia to the north. The idea of opposing the Soviets at the same time is militarily rather unthinkable to the Poles in 1939. They simply don't have the manpower and the resources to do it. So they had two sets of military plans, defensive plans, one an Eastern plan for dealing with the Soviet attack and then a Western plan for dealing with the German attack. But there's no concrete planning for dealing with an attack of both at the same time, because it was simply impossible to do so. So this is why the attack of particularly of the Soviets, which, you know, the invasion on 17th of September 1939, this is why this was so damaging to the Poles, because all of their forces were engaged in the West against the Germans. And those forces that were holding the Eastern frontier, very long Eastern frontier against the Soviet Union, were effectively, you know, border guards who had no artillery, had no air cover, very lightly armed, effectively policemen. And they're really no match. They're not meant to hold up the Red Army in a sort of massed invasion of 500,000 men. So they're in a very, very difficult situation. They simply don't have the wherewithal to hold both sides at the same time. So the Soviet invasion really was the death knell for the Poles in 1939, because they simply couldn't resist it.
Why were the Poles, civilian and military, surprised by the Soviet invasion?
That's a good question. I think to some extent they were not unaware of the hostility of the Soviet Union towards Poland, because that was kind of a given in the interwar years. This was, the country that they had fought against 1919-1920, It was still seen broadly as a sort of, the Soviet Union was still seen as a rogue state, effectively, in international affairs in the 1930s. And it was a revisionist state, crucially. So it was a state that wanted to revise the post-war status quo, wanted to revise the Versailles settlement. So in that sense, it was a natural ally of Germany, actually. When many people say, how come the Germans and the Soviets found common cause in 1939 and signed the Nazi-Soviet Pact? The easiest answer to that is that they're both revisionist powers. They both want to destroy the status quo as it was in 1939. So to a large extent, it shouldn't have been a great surprise that the Soviets would invade. But there were other aspects that rather clouded thinking in Warsaw. I mean, on the first point, I think the ambassador in Moscow, the Polish ambassador in Moscow, Grzybowski, was, I think, a little bit hoodwinked by the Soviets, perhaps even a bit naive. He didn't even necessarily see the attack coming on the 17th of September. A lot of the noises and the mood music coming out of Moscow at the time were not immediately aggressive towards Poland. There's lots of talk about the minorities and complaints about the status of Belarusian and Ukrainian minorities in Poland, which of course provides them with their propagandistic reason for going into Poland. But there's not necessarily much in the way of hostile rhetoric coming out. So I think the premise of the question is correct, that the Poles should have been a little bit more worldly wise to expect some sort of attack from the East. But due to circumstances and due to being distracted, to put it lightly, by the German attack in the West, they rather took their eyes off the ball.
As you mentioned at the beginning, one of the most common Western images of this campaign, insofar as there are any, is the iconic one of Polish cavalry attacking German tanks. What does the book actually uncover in terms of the realities of the campaign as per Polish cavalry, and how overall did Polish cavalry perform, militarily speaking?
It's a rather sort of central question, this one, because that sort of stereotype, as you say, of cavalry against tanks is one, you know, that is still remarkably durable, and we still hear it. A number of times I've heard it in the last year or so has really been quite mind-boggling. Polish cavalry in 1939, as I said, was really the elite. It was very much the cream of the Polish army. And it's remarkably well trained and well drilled, and they fought actually surprisingly well, even against German tanks and armor in 1939. Of course, they didn't charge tanks on horseback. That would be ridiculous. They're trained to fight dismounted, so they use their horses as for maneuverability. They dismount. They have very effective anti-tank rifles and small artillery pieces that they tow along with them. And as I said, fight dismounted. The horses are removed to the rear, and they fight remarkably effectively given those constraints. So the idea of Polish cavalry charging tanks in 1939 is nonsensical. One of the things that I wanted to look at was where this myth actually came from. And I discovered it, actually. There's a couple of engagements early on in the war. I think on day one, even, there's an engagement up in the Polish corridor where Polish cavalry actually engage and charge against German infantry. Now, that could still be, even in 1939, could be remarkably effective. As an ordinary infantryman, if you can imagine being borne down upon by a squadron of Polish cavalry, that would be a rather terrifying prospect. And it worked rather well. And there's a number of instances of Polish cavalry charging infantry, and with great effect, in 1939. But the problem is, of course, if you then get countercharged or counterattacked by a column of armor. And there's a couple of instances where that happened. And the event, the results are all too predictable of that engagement. So the cavalry charge still had its place in warfare, but they would never be silly enough to actually charge knowingly charge a column of German armor. So I wanted to look at where that myth came from. And it came, I think, from an Italian news reporter by the name of Indro Montanelli, who was, as we would nowadays say, embedded with German troops in 1939. And he witnessed the aftermath of an engagement on the Bzura, one of the main largest battles of the September campaign was the Battle on the Bzura, which is to the west of Warsaw. And he witnessed one of them, the aftermath of one of the engagements on the Bzura. And it was a sort of a, as you can imagine, a field of dead bodies of men and horses and everything in between. And it was rather harrowing. And he wrote a piece for the Corriere della Sera, which was then given the title, not by him, but obviously by the sub-editors back in Italy, given the title Cavalry Against Tanks. And I think that is where the myth comes from, because that story is then picked up by the German propaganda ministry under Goebbels and is then effectively run with and trumpeted, and with the subtext that, look at these foolish antediluvian primitive Poles who are attacking our tanks with their horses, which is a sort of peculiar reading of Montanelli's piece, because Montanelli's piece is not unsympathetic to the Poles, but it just describes this, the aftermath of this engagement. So I think that's the origin of the myth. And then, of course, once the propaganda ministry has this source, effectively, that they can point to and say, well, this isn't us telling this story, this is somebody else, then they run with it. And you can see this very quickly becomes a main theme of German propaganda of German accounts in that campaign. But it's, as I said, it's almost entirely mythical. I mean, the only instance where that would happen is where, as I said, a Polish cavalry squadron would be sort of countercharged or counterattacked by German armor. They would never attack German armor in a sort of charge formation. It's a rather unthinkable prospect.
And is it not fact the case that in the post-war period, one of the chief purveyors of this particular imagery was the communist regime, the subtext being that white Poland, the Poland of Sanjaka, was backward and therefore defeated, whereas the red Poland of post-1944 was not?
That's very true. And I mean, this is a much wider problem than that, is that there was nobody effectively post-war to tell the honest story of 1939. The Germans obviously went on to greater crimes. So they had much, their historians had greater crimes to investigate and expiate. The Soviets insisted all the way through that they didn't invade Poland in 1939, so it never featured in their historical narrative. For them, as for Putin's Russia, the war only starts in 1941, in spite of all the countries that they managed to attack and overrun in 1939-1940. The British and the French obviously had their own tribulations and their own victories to celebrate and write about, so they didn't write about 1939 and investigate it. So, and as I said, as you intimated, the Poles themselves, post-war communist regime, not only had no interest in telling the story of the pre-war regime, the pre-communist regime, it also, actively wanted to paint that regime in as black terms as possible. So you have this agenda which, wants to describe the pre-war regime as rather feckless, as rather, politically corrupt, ripe for being destroyed and all the rest of it. So it's a much wider problem. But you're right. If you look at the work of someone like Andrzej Wajda, the great Polish filmmaker who died not long ago, but one of his earliest films was called Lotna, which is actually includes within it a beautifully shot scene in black and white of Polish cavalry charging German tanks in 1939. And this was obviously at the behest of the communist regime. I think the film came out in something like 1956. So this was very obviously Polish communist propaganda. And as you say, it's a way of blackening the name of the pre-war Sanacja regime to a new generation of Poles to say, this is how corrupt your forebears were. We're not like this. We're much more sort of forward thinking and so on. but it's a way of blackening their name. That's absolutely true. But it works. It works just as well in the wider history of the September campaign as in this sort of micro history of the story of cavalry against tanks.
Yes, and that film, in some ways, rather beautiful, does have this iconic image of a sword attempting to slash the muzzle of a German tank.
Yes. I mean, it's a beautiful scene. Actually, it's beautifully shot, but unfortunately, it's propagandistic and historical nonsense.
Overall, what would be your assessment, militarily speaking, of the Polish Army's performance in this campaign?
I think within the constraints that they were working within, so both territorial, so obviously, as I said, they are very much up against it territorially, being surrounded on three sides, and also in terms of their grand political situation, that they have secured Western allies. They think they have these powerful allies in the West who will back them up and fight in their name, who actually then don't. So they're effectively betrayed by their Western allies. And I think betrayal is not too big a word. And then, of course, the disparity in technology and disparity in numbers of forces and even in sort of military doctrine, in the modern military doctrine that the Germans had particularly. And that, as I said, part of that is cultural and part of that is financial, that Poland simply didn't have the money to invest in any sort of in a real modernization. It did have some, had something like 300 tanks, and they were of a reasonable standard that could, if pushed, they could sort of stand toe to toe with the German tanks of the time, but they simply didn't have enough. The Germans had something like 2,500 tanks at this point. So they are not quite the sort of antediluvian force that we like to imagine. They are more advanced than that, but in comparison with Germany, which was then the most advanced military force on the planet, they really didn't stand too much of a chance. But if you bear all of those constraints in mind, in individual instances, you look at places like the Battle of Mława, the Battle of Mokra in the southwest, you look at the counterattack on the Bzura, from the 10th to the 12th, when it was in a successful period of the Polish counterattack, I think you can see that there's much there in the Polish performance to admire. And that's something that I think has been lost in this rather simplistic narrative of, cavalry against tanks and the Poles being inept. They're certainly not inept. They are facing fundamental difficulties. But in those circumstances, I think they fight rather well.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
I think it's the importance of, as in all of these books, of my books anyway, to take it on board that nuance is important. I think too often, particularly with popular history, we tend to have a very simplistic sort of boiled down narrative. This is how it was. It's almost like an elevator pitch. This is how it was. It's it's simplified to a point almost of absurdity. And history, unfortunately, really isn't like that. And this is why this idea of cavalry against tanks, partly why this has prevailed for so long, because it's a simplistic, straightforward, easy narrative. Life isn't like that. And we have to embrace this complexity. We have to, read a bit more around the subject, and we have to understand it better. And I think, secondarily to that is I think Poland has had a very tough 20th century for so many reasons. And to add to all of that difficulty that it's had, it tends to get written out of its own history too often. And this is partly linguistic. It's partly, I think, a sort of a throwback to the Cold War, that, Poland was behind the Iron Curtain, was to some extent out of sight and out of mind. I think Poland deserves its place in history, and certainly with stories like this, I'm trying to sort of write them back into the history, I hope I can sort of bring a few readers with me on that journey, because it is a fascinating story.
Upon that observation, which I agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Morehouse, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Morehouse.
My pleasure.